This podcast is brought to you by the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection Arcade Classics. 7 legendary titles including X-Men vs. Street Fighter and Marvel vs. Capcom 2. Enjoy new features like online multiplayer, training, and gallery modes. Plus, join in on the action with one-button specials, where players of all skill levels can unleash those epic moves with ease. Relive the classic arcade battles. Get your hands on the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection today. Available now on PlayStation 4, PC, and Nintendo Switch.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Welcome to Board Gamers Anonymous, the podcast of board gamers and the insane fun we have at the table together. This is Chris.
Hey, and this is Anthony.
And this is episode 491, Top 100 Games of All Time, number 100 to number 91. We'd like to thank all our Patreon backers for helping us bring you a brand new episode. Hello, friends. We're back. And we are talking about, and we often talk about the latest and the greatest, but this time, more than any time, it is the time we're about to hit our 500th episode. And typically with giant round numbers, we do our top 100. So for these last 10 episodes, previous episode, if you haven't listened to it, jump back. That was our BGA Hall of Fame top 10. We've never done it before. We took 10 games between Anthony and I, lovingly placed them on a shelf and said, these are the best, they're awesome, but they're not going to be included in the top 100.
Yes, right. Individually, because I think I have one that you retired, but...
And I have one that you retired, too. I took one of those games out, too.
Yeah, yeah. So it's non-exclusive, but these are games that we have taken off our own lists, which I think opens up a lot. I know for me, especially, it like radically overhauled like the top of my list,
same,
which we'll get to in a few weeks, but it was fun to be able to talk about it and fun to be able to run through and like these are why these games will always be amazing and forever be on the top of the list, but are no longer on the list.
It's true. So if you've listened up to this point, God bless you, because even I don't listen to this point. So it's been 500 episodes, give or take, and we've done a lot of top 100s. Sometimes we've done it on a single episode. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we've done it collaboratively, you and I, Anthony, or sometimes you and I and our special friend, special guest on the podcast. Sometimes we've taken over two episodes, give or take. This time, for the first time, I know it's kind of the standard for the industry, but we've never done it this way. So we're going to try something a little bit new for us, but old for everybody else, which is we're going to break down 10 each week. So you're going to get 20 of our top 100 games of all time, starting with, of course, number 100 down to number 91, leading us all the way down to our 500th episode, which, of course, is our 500 spectacular
and that's going to be the top 10 games of all time. That top 10 is going to probably surprise you a lot, because again, we just did our Hall of Fame, and I think the vast majority of those games came typically from our top 10.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot going on there. Like, one, yes, we retired some games. Two, like, how we play games has changed dramatically over the last, like, 4 years with COVID and everything.
But sure.
the last time we did this list was mid-2022, and that was a weird time.
Yes.
So fast forward a little more than 2 years.
It's a very dark period for tabletop gaming.
Right. So it's, like, it's just changed, for at least for me. I can't, you know, I can't speak for everybody, but it's changed how I think about games and how I play them and who I play them with. My kids are older. Everything has changed and adjusted. I teach with them now. Like, a lot of things have changed. And I think my list definitely reflects that.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I think. And also, I mean, there's a lot, like you said, there's a lot of personal dynamics, but there's also been a lot of changes in the industry.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And there's some of that's for the better. You know, you have a lot more deluxified models of games. Historically, games typically came with a core base game and then expansions that followed. Sometimes the expansion was cut out of the base game. Sometimes it's added to correct it. And sometimes it's just a quest for more money and just makes the game worse.
Yep.
So that dynamic was pretty rampant. And now, more or less in the days of Kickstarter, that just owns the space. Of course, GameFound, and there's other sources as well. It's a little different. So now you get the game, and typically you get everything with the game, more or less. So that game experience is different. Obviously, because of COVID, because of the lockdowns, because of, you know, the financial crises around the world, some of the supply chain issues, of course. Friendly local game stores are few and far between. So also a lot of the organized plays that a lot of games lived or died by, it's so much harder to get those games to the table.
Yeah, I think we both removed games that kind of relied on that, and we just weren't able to play anymore.
100%. It's really sad, because a lot of these games are very good, but without that support from the publisher, that changed.
Right.
And obviously, we talked about the industry, too. The industry has certainly changed. Asmodee, major player over the last decade or more at this point. And how it's changed hands, and how it's changed companies, and how companies have responded to that. Again, a lot of change throughout. So, different things happening. And then also, I guess, on the other side, we talked about the deluxified games, but the rise of the big box games. The simplified versions of a lot of our, you know, favorite tabletop games. So instead of Gloomhaven, there's Jaws of the Lion, right? Instead of King of Tokyo with all its monsters and stuff, now you have the condensed kind of version of that. Spirit Island, instead of all of its pieces and wonder, now you have the little cardboard version. Doesn't make it a bad game. And we did a whole episode on those games. But again, those games are getting out to the public in a more, you know, surprising way. So a lot of changes throughout, which obviously affected our top 100, because games are meant to be played with people. So our experiences are, I guess, made better or influenced by a lot of the gamers that we get to play. And those spaces have changed, and those gamers have changed. New gamers, different gamers come in and out, different spaces to play, losing a lot of the third spaces, getting some. Digital tabletop gaming becoming even more part of, like, the general zeitgeist. Like, now we're actually talking about tabletop gaming online in a positive way.
That was not
the way it was. They were like, oh, I got a new tabletop game app, and they're like, oh, I am so sorry, how much did you pay for that? So
yeah.
a lot of changes, and obviously technology too, because again, a lot of those apps back in the day, not the best as far as working with a tabletop game, but now quite good in a lot of cases.
Yeah, yeah. And you see things like board games launch day and date with the Board Game Arena version, because that sells games. It gets people into the games. It's a fascinating way to look at it. Like, there was a game, it's not in my top 100 this year, I don't think. I think it came off, but it was on my list last time exclusively because of Board Game Arena. with Carnegie. Like, I didn't have a physical copy of the game when I put it on my list, but I had played it a bunch that year.
Sure.
And so that was a weird thing. Again, I think it fell off the list because I don't play on Board Game Arena as much as I used to, but it's weird to have that option.
Mm-hmm.
And it's affecting how we play games and how we interact with each other, which is
100%. Cool. Yeah, it's a different experience, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse.
That's true.
Sometimes brings you to purchase a game, sometimes repels you.
Yeah.
I can't imagine people going on Board Game Arena and trying to play Agricola or Scythe on those kind of platforms.
Yeah.
Or Terraforming Mars.
I'm glad that they can, but it is some of these games you're like, that doesn't seem like a good fit.
No. There's too few screens for the amount of table space that those things take up.
Right.
So, yeah, there's been some positive implementations. Dune Imperium, obviously, has been quite good.
Yeah.
Wingspan was quite good. There's been a lot of good games out there. But again, for people coming into the industry and not knowing and experiencing these games for the first time, obviously, it's critical that they experience them the right way. And then, of course, there's the like Tabletop Simulator and Tabletopia, which, you know, take it or leave it. Sometimes it's a good implementation. Sometimes it's not. It's a little messy for me, but some people like it.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of changes throughout the times, a lot of changes throughout the year. So a lot of changes to our top 100 list, and our approach to the top 100 list obviously has changed slightly. Some of that stuff we've talked about previously, some of that stuff we've talked on our Patreon episodes. And what we're going to do here is we're going to talk about, again, our top 10 from the bottom end, and talk a little bit about the game itself, our experiences and plays with it, and of course, why we feel like it deserves that top spot. Because honestly, any game in this top 100 is a great game.
Yeah.
And we should also say, this is a definitive list, people. The list.
Oh, yeah. These are the only games you should play.
I mean, come on, people.
Yeah. Like, seriously, why even bother?
I don't even know why Board Game Geek exists. I mean, after we finish this, they're going to go out, right? They're done.
That's true. It's true.
Because we did 500 episodes. So like they're like, they did it.
Yeah. It is funny, though. Like, I look at, like, just for this week, I look at the 10 games you have listed. I think maybe one of these is in my top 100.
Ooh.
We have a lot of overlap in general, but we do. Often towards the bottom of our list, not so much.
Yes.
No, zero. No, that one didn't make it. So zero overlap.
Oh, no. We were so close.
I know. I don't know if any of mine are on your later list, but none of yours are on mine. So
there you go.
But that's a good thing. It's like, it shows there's just, you know, these are great games. It doesn't mean because one of us doesn't have it that the other does that it's not good. It's just, there's only so many games you can rank, right? I was looking through my Board Game Stats app, and I had played over the last 10 years 2,600 unique games.
Wow.
So a lot of them are bad. But a lot of them are good. And even just like everything I've rated like a 7.5 and higher on Board Game Geek, there was several hundred. So
sure.
There's a lot to choose from here.
Yeah, a couple for me going through my Board Game Geek, you know, just on Board Game Geek alone, over 1,000 ratings. Obviously, much more than that, just the stuff I just put in Board Game Geek alone. And I think from looking at your 10 that we're going to talk about this week, there's one got one. There was one that was close. There's one that's almost an honorable mention here, but there's one that's later on my list. I won't say where or when, but it's later on my list.
Yeah, I think the higher we get, the more overlap we end up having, which it's kind of a funny thing, but there are some games that are just really, really good.
Sure.
We do have similar tastes. That's why we have a podcast together. So
it's awesome.
Yeah.
And after 500 episodes, it becomes a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It'd be funny if we hated each other's games. Like every episode would just be like that tier list we did of Agricola versus A Feast for Odin, where everybody got really mad because we're both wrong.
Well, at least we drew a consensus amongst our friends out there.
Yeah, right. The consensus was not that, oh yeah, Feast for Odin's greater. Oh yeah, Agricola's great. Like, no, you're both idiots. They're both great games. Shut up.
There you go. Excellent. Love that. Love to hear that.
Yeah.
So, and again, we've learned a lot from everybody out there. Again, we can't stop thanking you so much for posting on our social media to our questions of the week, just sending us emails about great games that you got to the table, commenting on the show, of course. We've learned a lot from everyone out there, and your suggestions obviously helps us get games to the table. And of course, your ratings, your reviews, your conversations with publishers and designers and other gamers at the table about the podcast, about BGA and all the different things that BGA does allows us to do this. So thank you so incredibly much for listening. We're so happy to get into this list and learning more about these great games. Don't forget, as we do every year, there's the listener top list. So after we get through our list, we're going to do our listeners top list. And we'll talk more about that. So give you an opportunity to let us know about what are your greatest games. And again, hopefully that kind of inspires us to get those games to the table as well. So thank you again, especially to our Patreon backers. This would not be possible without everybody out there. So again, if you have not done so before, whatever podcast player or YouTube channel you're listening to, please like, subscribe, do all those kind of things. I know it's a little bit of a headache. I know you have to stop and do those things, but it does make a huge difference for the algorithm. It makes a huge difference for the publishers because we're a podcast. It doesn't matter that 15,000 people are listening, 20,000 people are listening. They only look at the numbers that they can see on the videos. So it means a lot. And again, we hope to get to see you at all the upcoming conventions, especially PAX coming up.
Yeah, we're almost there.
All right. So again, see you on all those social medias, especially on Patreon, because there's a lot of good stuff that we do there each and every week, and especially Anthony's wonderful webpage, BoardGamersAnonymous.com. So Anthony, with that said, let's get into the list.
All right. I will kick us off with number 100. And this is a game that was on my list last time. It dropped down a little bit, but it's always kind of been at the top end of my list just because we can get into that. Grand Austria
it knows what Hotel. It knows what it did.
Yes. Grand Austria Hotel. So this is one of those Euro games that when I sit down to play it, I'm like, everything about this is perfect, right? I love the theme. The artwork is so fun. The dice mechanisms, the action selection, the way you get the cards. And then there's just that one element, which you've pointed out 100 times, of the cards themselves are not particularly balanced in how they come out.
Sure.
Some people get better things than other things. And sometimes what you're trying to accomplish is not possible.
Yeah.
So this very fun system doesn't quite work because of a deck of cards, which could apply to like thousands of games.
It's true.
Like, it's a brilliant design, but you're relying on a deck of cards and that breaks it. Now I won't go as far as saying it's broken. I've always enjoyed it. This is a game that it, again, just like the way that the dice mechanism works and when you roll those out and the actions you're going to take are based on the dice that you end up drafting. I always really enjoy that across any kind of game.
Yes.
Like my favorite game of all time is basically that, right? Or the ring, you roll your dice, you have actions based on those die rolls. That part is the most fun. And with the expansion that we got with the, what was that? The Let's Waltz.
Yes.
It added a bunch of modules that made the game even more interesting. It didn't necessarily fix that problem.
It did not.
Problem's still there, but it added a bunch of cool stuff. And it now, did. I don't like rating games with expansion included unless the expansion came with it to start.
Sure.
Or it's been repackaged. So I'm not going to say, oh, you have to play with the expansion. That's why it's number 100. What I will say is that the expansion made me play the game more often and come to a better appreciation of it. It also has a pretty significantly polished solo mode in it that allows me to play the base game more.
Nice.
So I really enjoyed Grand Austria Hotel the first time I played it. I had trouble getting it to the table a bunch after that. The expansion made that possible. The upgrades made that possible. The solo mode makes that possible. And it's all around. It's not Virginio Gili and Simone Luciani's best game by a long shot, but it's very good. It's very fun. Like, it reminds me of, like, I don't know, it just gives me those vibes, like, you know, the Grand Budapest Hotel or something, right? Like, it's like being in a Wes Anderson movie. And it's a fun feeling, even if occasionally the mechanics annoy me. So I like keeping it on my list for that reason, even if it's way down here at number 100.
This was, I think this had been on my top 100 from time to time on, you know, the high end, because I, as you know, you said, I talked endlessly about just that deck, and that deck kind of can break you as far as like, you get a piece of cake, you score 20 points, 20 endgame points, or you get some sort of engine. And again, I love everything else about the game. Like, again, it's very highly rated for me. And this was a game that it would have been in my top 100 but I had to pull something. And that was the kind of breaking point for me. I have the crowdfunded edition, all, you know, with the Let's Waltz expansion. And I don't know what they were thinking. I guess they were like, let's not fix whatever the issue was with that. Let's just add more. And then it dilutes the issue. And I'll agree, it does dilute the issue, because now you can go other places and score other points. It does become a little overwrought a little bit, because now you have multiple boards and things like that. But it's still not a bad game. It certainly would be in my, I don't know, top 120, I think, easily. My top 110. But again, it was just like I had to cut something out, and that just kind of got cut. But not for lack of loving the game as it is.
Sure.
All right. Well, my top 100 game, and again, it's always hard, the top 100 game. You have a lot of love for that top 100 game, because it's like on it teeters on that edge.
Right. Yeah.
It's like you could just not be spoken about ever again, but also like you know, it's the bronze medal, right? It got something. You can't be mad at it. It got something. The game that it's got something is Tokaido from 2012. Now, there is a Super Deluxe Edition, which I do own. It's super white inside and out, so it's never going to see any kind of real table time. That was a Kickstarter way back in the day. I think it was like 2014, give or take. This game is, again, please forgive me, it's zen, right? It's a very straightforward, simple game that you are walking down the famed Tokaido Road, and you're stopping at different locations to have like the most wonderful vacation possible. There's hot springs, there's foods, there's landscapes that are being painted, there's different interactions with different people. You have a unique character who has a special ability, and it's zen. It's got this very serene feel to it. It's easily playable by a large number of people. If you said, if I was going to a game night and I didn't know who was going to be there as far as gamers were concerned, Tokaido's a great choice, because it's like you have a character piece. You know, if you're on the back of the line, you now move. You move to any spot that you want across the road. And then you take that resource. That's it. Pretty straightforward and simple, but yet it does have enough complexity for gamers that you can mid-max certain sections. You can ensure that like you're blocking out money, or you're trying to take all the prints, or you're utilizing your character's ability to the best way possible. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful game. The artwork here is just gorgeous. The designer, Anton Bauza, knows everything about how to make this kind of weight game. And I've enjoyed it for so many years that it still sticks around on this, you know, top 100.
Yeah, Tokaido's an amazing game. It's one of those games that I picked up at some point because I'm like, oh, the family will love this someday. And the family was deeply unimpressed. And I was like, you're all disowned. Go outside.
Good.
But
did the right thing, man.
Yeah. So I haven't actually played it in a very long time for that reason. It's just, it didn't click. I think I sold it. But all that said, I still think it's an amazingly fun game. And with the expansion content especially, which again, yes, I mean, we're not rating things based on that, but it just adds so much. So great choice.
It does. And I think the expansions are, it's good to put that into discussion.
Yeah. Yeah. It's worth mentioning, because if you're going to get one of these games, often you're like, what else can I get? And that is always an option.
Very much so. So yeah, check out Tokaido, and especially with the expansions, if you want a little more extra crunch to your game, and I think you'll really enjoy it. So yeah. Tokaido's my number 100.
All right. So number 99 for me is my first entry from Uwe Rosenberg, but not the last. You will hear more from
who? Who's this Uwe guy? Yes. First I'm hearing of him.
Ed Rosenberg. More coming. So this is I always struggle to rate the Rosenberg games, because at any given day I'll say that one of them is my favorite, and another day I'm like, no, now this is my favorite. Are days when I'm like, At the Gates of Luoyang is my favorite, but it's not right now. It's number 99, which is still amazing. It's still an amazing game. It's just not my favorite of his games. So At the Gates of Luoyang is a game that I didn't really recognize as an Uwe Rosenberg game the first time I played it. Because I remember we had this conversation way back when of like, Rosenberg's games are interesting, but like, can we just do the vegetable part?
Yes.
And then someone's like, oh yeah, it's like At the Gates of Luoyang. I'm like, oh, what's that? I want to play that one. It's just buying and selling vegetables. So it's unique in so many different ways. Like, you do plant things. Mm-hmm. You have cards like with plots. You start with one. You gain one more every round. You can get more out of the deck. But and you plant your vegetables there, and then they grow, and you harvest them each round. And then you're trying to use those to fulfill different contracts with regular customers, one-time customers. You get these people who can come help you out with special abilities. It's very, very clever and very, very difficult. Like, the scoring mechanism makes it so you're not going to score very many points. Like, mm-hmm. you are paying the cost of the points each time. So if you're at 7 and you want to go to 8, you need to pay 8 money. That's a lot of money. It takes a lot to do that. So I've always enjoyed this game because of how tight it is, because of how kind of grueling it can be. And the solo mode is, I think, the best of any Rosenberg solo mode because of like the grid and the drafting of the cards that you do from that grid. So At the Gates of Luoyang, it's like 5 pieces of wood and a deck of cards in this giant box. So every time I pick it up, I'm like, oh yeah, there's nothing in here. But it's one of the better 5 pieces of wood and a deck of cards in a box.
100% agree. It's one of those games that, for whatever reason, in the discussion of Rosenberg games, almost never comes up.
Yeah, because it's not in the whole, it's not a worker placement game, right? And that's what people think of. They think of worker placement and polyominoes. This is neither.
Yes. So. It does have that little clunky situation at the very beginning of the rounds where you get the cards and you have to kind of like swap the cards and choose the cards and things like that.
Yeah, so yeah. You keep you put some in the market.
Yeah, it's a little odd as far as that's concerned. And I think it's easy to come into that game and just not get it, at least initially, and just get like clunked.
Yeah.
But that being said, once you know it, it's probably one of, if not his smoothest games.
It is.
Like, it's so very elegant. And it's a very lovely game. It's like you said, it's very low on the component count, but it makes sense. It works. It's fun. And yet it's also one of his like classic games where you feel like there's a knife to your throat the whole game, right? Yep. Like, yep. Can you make the sales? Can you pick something else extra? And yet at the same time, it doesn't feel punitive. It feels like you are an entrepreneur reaching out and being a little more aggressive.
Yeah, because if you get hurt, it's because you made a bad decision.
Yes.
Like, you took a customer that you couldn't fulfill.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're getting negative points. That's on you. You did that.
Yes.
So I always love that feeling of like, because something bad can happen in a game. You're like, that wasn't me. That's, you took the spot I needed. The card didn't come out that I needed. You know, I could have done something different, but what is it? And at the Gates of Luoyang, you could look at it and be like, I shouldn't have done that. That was a bad decision. And that's not a fun feeling, but it's a useful feeling in a game like this, and it makes the game better.
All right, well, we might come back to this game at a later point.
Ooh.
All right, for me, my number 99 game is, I just talked about Takedo and just having such a wonderfully unique artistic theme and presence. Well, almost similar, but the opposite of that is my number 99 game, which is Abyss. This is the game that kind of like broke all board game box covers. It was one of 4 different designs of one of these 4 different powerful senators, underwater creature senators, and it's just their face. Their dynamic, beautiful, wonderful artwork. Now, it's just so evocative. Now, you play the game itself from Bruno Cathala and Charles Cavalier, and again, one of my favorite artists, Xavier Collette, who I'll also speak about later again. Abyss is this wonderful game where you're building up your tableau by working the Senate to get votes together. And these different votes are from the different sea creatures in the ocean. And then having the right, the combinations allows you to sway that particular senator to your side. That senator, again, from one of these different aquatic classes, has special abilities. You play that to your tableau, and that will give you special abilities throughout. And then there's an opportunity, again, based upon gaining pearls, which is very thematic. You actually have these little plastic pearls and this little clamshell that you'll be able to use in the game. And you'll be able to get locations that are going to score those particular senators or a number of other things in the game. And just like, I guess we talked about recently, Elysium, right? You get them into scoring you points and giving you options and activities. And then at the same time, it gives you an opportunity to kind of like ascend them for scoring points. So there's a lot of layers to the scoring that goes on in the game. And throughout the whole time, very thematic, very colorful, very engaging. And you can also interact and mess with other players throughout the way. But at no point is it overwhelming. This is a really wonderful medium to lightweight game. So I love Abyss.
It's pretty, definitely pretty game. It's one of those games that like, I played early on because everybody was excited to have their copy, and I really didn't get a chance to play it as much as I would like after that. But every time it's come to the table, most of the time by you, it's like, this is pretty. And the artwork really holds up, even after, what, 10 years now?
It's crazy.
Yeah. All right, number 98 for me is, you guessed it, another Uwe Rosenberg game.
What?
I know. And that's not all of them. So this is the newest one, I think. I think it's the newest one from him on my list. No, it's not, actually. Sorry. There's another one newer than this. But this is Atiwa. Mm-hmm. This is the Bat game. Came out in 2022. So we first played this at PAX in probably 2022. And I picked up a copy later last year.
Mm-hmm.
And it is your typical worker placement style, building out your tableau in front of you, type of Uwe Rosenberg game. You have a central board, you have workers you're placing there. Some of them give you resources, some of them let you convert things, some of them let you get new plots to plant things on. But what makes the game unique is that everything kind of flows into each other. Like, the game's all about sustainability. So, like, if you want fruit, you need to plant trees because the trees will produce the fruit. And if you want bats, you need fruit because the bats will eat the fruit, right? Everything flows into each other. And on your personal player board, where all these pieces are lined up, they're in the order in which they affect each other. Like, you need this to get this, to get this, to get this, to get this. So you're constantly putting things on your board and taking them off and putting something else on and putting something, like, because you're cycling through these things to get them out. Ultimately, you want to have a lot of people out, but you need to be able to support those people and then ultimately feed those people, because it's Rosenberg. And I guess what I really just like about the game is it has this element to it with the bats that if you train the families to live with the bats, to become more sustainable, to live within the space, there's a benefit to that, right? You don't get the pollution that sure. can cover up your cards and block the spaces, because the cards are a limited resource. You can only have so many of them. They're hard to get. They're expensive. And that's where you put your resources. So if you run out of places to put stuff on those cards, you cannot bring more out. You cannot continue building your engine. And then that, you suddenly don't have the ability to keep up with people who are building their engines. So you need to be sustainable in how you're putting things out, and you want to get as many bats as you can out. I just really like this. It is a spin on a lot of his other formulas. It's on the lighter end of his type of games. It's pretty straightforward. I could teach the game in, 15 minutes, but it does so many interesting, cool light things. Like, Rosenberg sometimes brings ideas to his games that then get translated and built into the mecanics. Not like Lacerda level, but like enough that you can see them and how he's thinking about it and what he wants you to get out of it. And I really appreciate that. So Atiwa is, it's been a favorite since it came out just a couple years ago. It's my number 98.
Yeah, this was a surprising game. It also really uniquely takes on that kind of sustainability issue, and in a really interesting kind of way. And I think that's one of those things where, like, you don't think about that, but it's built into the game here very thematically.
Yep.
And it's really nice to see. And the pieces are very good. It's a very dynamic, colorful game for him.
You get bat meeples. Little bat meeples. They're cute.
Jeez, the number of times you kept saying I'm Batman, I mean, it got a little bit overboard, Anthony.
But. I know, and nobody was happy with it, and we finished the game. And all three of you were like, yeah, that's a game. And I'm like, this is my favorite game ever.
I'm Batman.
Like, you're not Batman. Those people in the village are Batman. I'm like, whatever. It's fine.
Yeah. No, it's good to see him do something different than his typical. I mean, there's elements of it that we've seen before.
Right.
So.
Yep. Great game.
All right. On my side here, we're going to take a look at number 98. This is a new addition to the list. Dune Imperium Uprising. This is the re-implementation, the rejiggering, the, I don't know, how would you say it? The recasting because of the second movie that came out recently, where there was a little conversation. I wouldn't necessarily say controversy, but Dune Imperium was out. And I think with two expansions, Anthony?
Yeah.
Two expansions that came out. Dune Imperium's a great game. Dune Imperium with the expansions, better game. Dune Imperium Uprising, for me, I think is, I don't want to say the definitive edition, because I feel like I need to play it more before I can say, would I rather play the original version with the two expansions or this one? But right now, the Uprising edition with the spies allowing you, I think, a little more flexibility in the game, plus some additional scoring that goes along with it, and the opportunity to not be held back, at least in the base game, to this scoring that really only, you know, ticks up at the very end, right? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, there's just this battle's worth two. Like, now you can actually score more points earlier based upon what, you know, military you'll be able to put in play. The worms come into play a lot earlier. There's more factions involved, and it kind of takes some of the best parts of the base game and the expansion. So yeah, Dune Imperium, my number 98.
Dune Imperium, I have not played Uprising, so I can't really speak to the differences, the changes. Like, what you described sounds really fun and interesting. I will be talking about the other game later.
Oh, probably.
But this one I don't have as much experience with, but so I do hope to play it soon.
So kind of technically we do have a match there.
Kind of
in a manner of speaking,
maybe.
Yeah,
I don't know. I haven't played this one. All right. Number 97 for me, also an IP game, was on my list last time, dropped a little bit just because I haven't played it as much. And that is Lord of the Rings Journeys in Middle Earth. So this is the app based Lord of the Rings campaign game that came out in 2019. And I know a lot of people hear that here app based and they're like, checking out, not interested, which fair. Don't begrudge you that, but I don't mind it. So this is based on kind of, they're like, oh, it's like Mansions of Madness mixed with Descent. And I'm like, kind of. I mean, yeah, but not really. It's a Lord of the Rings campaign game. And the only really bad thing the game has going for it in the base set is you don't get to like go through the story of Lord of the Rings. Like, they wrote something unique and different, which is fine, but it's not quite as interesting as you'd get. Like, are we doing The Hobbit? Which is what the card game ran into as well, which is why they released those sets. So that's the one thing for this that I always wish they had done, and I probably would have brought back to the table more. But the game itself is fantastic, right? The app walks you through all the story, it reads everything to you, it gives you all these amazing scenarios, it randomizes the locations and settings of the enemies and stuff. Makes it really easy to play with kids, like this type of campaign game, because I don't have to keep track of everything everybody's doing. It's on the screen, and then I can make sure we're all working together. And then the card mechanic here was what really makes the game the most interesting, is there are symbols on the cards that will indicate whether you've succeeded or not at whatever you're trying to do. So you have a little deck of cards that you're constantly flipping through. And then you get new things, you add them in, you find stuff, you get loot. So it's like a dungeon crawl, but it has like this very targeted, simple card mechanic that really allows you to focus in on your character and focus in on your role on the map. So it's one of those adventure games that really stuck with me. I think the app integration is really good, and I think the card mechanics and the integration of the theme is fantastic. And there's expansion content I haven't gotten to yet, so I will get this back to the table in the future as well. So Lord of the Rings Journeys in Middle Earth, this is like, of all of those big box app-based Fantasy Flight games, this is the one that I really get to the table. I don't really play Imperial Assault much anymore. I got rid of Mansions of Madness a few years back, but this one still hits the table pretty regularly. So, Journeys of Middle-Earth.
Well, that's pretty high praise, because there's a lot of those big ones, and Fantasy Flight always has done a really good job with those.
It's one of those games that I wasn't going to get, and then when I watched a gameplay video, I'm like, oh, that actually looks really cool. And thankfully it was, because it was also very expensive.
So. Yeah, because they basically made their bones on Descent.
Right.
That was their kind of flagship for those kind of games. Sadly, I've not played this, so I can't speak to it. But
we should play it sometime. It's so easy to get up and going.
I would like to play that then.
Yeah.
Let's do that thing. All right. Well, the next one up for me, taking a look at number 97. This is a game that's been on my list for very many years, and surprisingly so. It's Dixit Journey. Now, there are a lot of versions of Dixit that are out there. I think I played all of them, more or less. I think there may be one or two. I own a crazy number of the expansions. Dixit Journey is one of those surprising games because it just should not work, right? It's one of those kind of party games that just like, oh, pictures, and you say a thing and you play them out and then people guess and you get points. Like, there's just like an endless number collection of those games. One of the things that Dixit had done quite well was the artwork. From there's many artists throughout Dixit. The artwork that I really connect with, and other people have connected with and just remarked upon endlessly. Again, and I mentioned earlier, Xavier Collette. Dixit Journey is a departure from the more abstracted artwork that was out there previously. It's still abstracted. It still has a lot of different natures to it, but it's just the sharper, the aesthetic is different. And I mean, the box alone shows all the artwork off, so they knew what they were talking about as far as the game's concerned. Now, the thing about Dixit, if you have not played Dixit, it does go above and beyond that kind of traditional party game, because yes, you are giving a clue about the card that you're going to play out hidden, and then everyone's going to make a decision based upon your clue what card to throw in there as well, because what everybody wants to have happen is their card to be picked. So it's not just like the traditional party game, like I'm the judge and I make the decision. No, everyone at the table gets to try to figure out, deduce what the clue is. Now, if you give too simple of a clue, no points. Too easy of a clue, no points. You really want to get one or two people to guess it. So that intellectual, you know, algorithm mathematics that are going on to try to figure out, well, maybe they get this, but I can't make it too simple and so forth. And then everyone else's calculations in their head about what cards do they have in their hand that might match this and that they want to play to kind of guess. It really engages everyone at the table. And again, the artwork is so beautiful. Like I on my own Facebook page, I posted endless number of Dixit cards because I just think they're so evocative of whatever particular experience or emotion that they're trying to elicit. So, Jean-Louis Robert, I mean, just brilliant game. Dixit Journey, a lot of versions of Dixit are out there. They're all relatively the same or good. This wouldn't be the one that I would recommend for the artwork and for the number of players that it plays with.
Dixit's great. I love Dixit. It's a game that I own multiple copies of because I use it in my classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an instant hit with like everybody.
It is.
It like transcends all those social anxieties because you're trying to interpret this wonderful artwork.
I mean, it's the big tarot card size cards that, and the artwork. If it seems smart, it looks smart. It doesn't look cheap or silly, and it's actual artwork. It's not AI generated, you know, nonsense.
Yeah, thankfully. All right, number 96 on my list, we have Marvel United, which thankfully I spent enough money on this thing. I'm glad it made my list. This is not confirmation bias. I do actually like this game, and it rated accordingly, but it's one of those things that, like, at a certain point I had bought enough of it, and I was like, do I even like this?
Mm-hmm.
And then I think I spent a weekend at your house, Chris, and we played, I don't know, 10 or 15 games of X-Men United. I'm like, yeah, this is amazing. This is great. I love this. I just need to play it more than once when I pull it out. It's very, very simple. Like, it's incredibly accessible. The wait, you know, sub two, very simple cooperative type of play. But, like, the fact that every single decision you make in terms of setting up the game, like which characters you want to be, what villain you're going to face, it always makes the game slightly different. And then there's scenarios on top of that, right? You could go run the Fantastic Four out there, or you can go up against the Sentinels, or whatever it is you want to do. Like, there's a lot of different ways to kind of build and play the game. Now, the base box by itself, not particularly interesting. It's when you get all that other stuff in there. But there's enough of that other stuff in retail that I feel comfortable recommending it. And for myself, it's just become a game that I can throw out when I'm like, I don't want to think tonight. I want to play a game. I want to do something analog. I've been staring at the screen all day, but I don't have friends over. Kids are going to bed. I just want to do something kind of mindless, put on like The Simpsons in the background or something. Marvel United is often that game, not because it's, you know, forgettable, but because it is fulfilling while not being taxing.
Good point.
And there's just not a lot of those games that click with me, right? Like, I'm not a big dice chucker kind of guy. I don't love those types of games. I'm like, I'm gonna run around on a map and kill stuff. Like, I don't love that. I want there to be strategy and tactics to it, but occasionally I don't want to think, and this is that game. I don't really want to think right now. and sometimes you do need to. Like, some of these scenarios are hard.
Yes.
So I have whatever 400 or 500 figures now across the three releases of Marvel United. It will be playing this forever. Probably never get through all of it. Mm. I'm sure you're in the same boat.
Same. This was another game that was floating within just above my top 100. And I don't think I gave it maybe enough consideration. I did consider it. Mm. And I think I felt like it was a little biased of a pick because I think they did such a good job with X-Men United. Mm-hmm. That it almost was like, yeah, but I feel like this is, you know, especially good. Marvel United is also very good, and I'm sure the DC United is going to be good. They just, I think, mentioned or released or talked about Arkham Asylum, so you're going to get all the Batman, you know, rogue gallery as they were there as well. But I think you make the very good point that this is a puzzle, and it's an ongoing active shifting puzzle that you're playing. And I, as you mentioned, I played this solo so much just because I get to pick my team.
Yeah.
And I'm looking, when I'm from looking at the characters, I can, you know, suss out what works best or what, you know, what tactic I want to play. And then it's very thematic to the characters, considering it's a very simplistic, dumbed down kind of version of the characters. So if I think I'm going to take a lot of damage, I'm going to go with like Wolverine and the Wolverine crew, right? If I think that I need like, you know, more power here or more movement, I know what characters to put together. And I think that's a lot of fun. And it brings a lot of knowledge to table. And yet, because of the chibi nature of it, a lot of people will play it. And again, I can ratchet up and down the complexity to it based upon the particular scenarios that I decide to play. And then there's a lot of extras as far as like gearing up your characters and stuff too. So it's a deep cut, but I think it's a very good one.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection Arcade Classics. 7 legendary titles, including X-Men vs. Street Fighter and Marvel vs. Capcom 2. Enjoy new features like online multiplayer, training, and gallery modes. Plus, join in on the action with one-button specials, where players of all skill levels can unleash those epic moves with ease. Relive the classic arcade battles. Get your hands on the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection today. Available now on PlayStation 4, PC, and Nintendo Switch.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of 5-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's a great game.
My number 96 is Arboretum. This is a small box card game that, you know, right from the start impressed me and continues to impress me to this day. Because when it comes to small box card games, you really have to have something. It just can't be okay. There's so very many card games out there. I mean, just think of your normal deck of 52 playing cards and all the things you could play with that. So if you're going to give me a small box card game, it's got to do something great. Arboretum is a strategy card game, 2 to 4 players, and it combines a lot of different elements that I like. Set collection, always very nice. Tile laying, right? You're setting up this kind of particular tableau. And you also, when you're playing cards, the cards that you're playing or you're giving up to the other players, so there's some tactical play, not necessarily hate drafting, so to speak, but as far as what you're able to score in your particular tableau really is, you know, like if it's in flux throughout the game as far as what you're putting together, what other people are putting together. And then on top of which is the gorgeous artwork here. A number of different artists, you know, lend themselves to this. Dan Cassier, the designer of the game, put together a brilliant tactical game that really does stress you out while you look at beautiful cards on the table as you're crafting your Arboretum. So yeah, Arboretum, 96.
All right. Angry Tree Game. Love these Angry Tree games. Like
that's right.
Anything with plants, you're like, okay, now your plant's going to cover their plant and they're going to lose all their points.
I should also mention it has literally, and I know a lot of people have mentioned this, we mentioned this way back in the day, the best tiebreaker of any game ever.
Yeah.
Which is you and your opponent who have tied after doing all the other tiebreakers have to each go plant a tree. And then after, I think it's a year, whoever tree has grown higher is the winner of that game. So
I want to know if anybody's actually done that.
That'd be funny.
Like actually done that too. Not like internet did that.
Yes.
Like picture evidence have done that. That's fantastic. All right. Number 95 on my list here is, The Crew, mm-hmm. specifically Mission Deep Sea. So, you know, I just talked about Marvel United and I kind of bucketed all of it together because it's the same system. In this case, I'm going to call out Mission Deep Sea in particular because it takes what happened in the quest for Planet Nine, which was the first release of this game, and also happened to be the one that won all the awards the year before, including the Kenner Spiel. And it doesn't change it, it just refines it in a lot of ways and makes it better, just generally better. Everything's better, right? There's like, it's one of those situations, like there's really no reason to play the quest for Planet Nine unless you prefer space to underwater, and even then it's a card game, it doesn't really matter. So the goal of the game, it's a trick-taking game, but it's cooperative. You have missions and you can't talk to each other, and that's it. That's the whole pitch, and it works so well until it doesn't and you start yelling at each other. But most of the time it works really well, right?
Yes.
And if one of the people in your group is half asleep and keeps making mistakes, go play a different game. Because it's not working then. It's just, and what makes this game so interesting is not just, okay, there's a goal we need to work towards. It is, there are multiple missions and they increase in complexity, right? And then in this particular version, Mission Deep Sea, it allows you to kind of build those missions based on what you're trying to accomplish, like the complexity that you want and how many players you have and so on and so forth. Quest for Planet Nine, it was like, here's 50 missions, go through them in order. Eventually you hit a wall. For most people around mission 10 to 15. I think my group got stuck on 14 at a certain point. this one kind of helps work around that and also adds some interesting mechanics. But effectively, it's just trick-taking with the co-op element. Okay, the green triangle, or the eight green, the triangle, needs to go out first. So whoever has that card knows they need to win the first trick, right? So everybody else should know, play your low green cards so that the person with the high green card can play it and win the trick, right? It's like that unspoken communication. And it works in this game in a way that a lot of games it doesn't, with the unspoken communication. So the crew of Mission Deep Sea, I was immediately enamored with this when the first time I played it. I continue to play it. I always throw it in my bag when I'm going to game nights. I don't bring it to class because it's a little too complicated for my students, but I've had multiple students borrow it from me just because they're fascinated with the idea of a cooperative trick-taking game. So it's great. The crew of Mission Deep Sea.
The only question I have about this game, I mean, I have a lot of questions about this game. I like this game a lot. It didn't make my top 100. Is this because it's a co-op trick-taking game, is this a better teaching game as far as trick-taking is concerned? Like, to teach trick-taking? Or is it a better game after you have kind of mastered trick-taking?
After, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, the co-op element creates so much more confusion for people.
Sure.
Because you have to work against your self-interest more often than
yes,
right? Like, sometimes you're like, I have the nine. You're like, don't play that.
But anytime I play a trick-taking game, that's what I want to do.
I want to win the tricks. I'm like, no, you don't have, you see the thing you have? It says you need to win the last trick. That's it. That's all you need to do.
That's what I'm saying. That's the tricky part of that trick-taking game, is it goes against everything you learned about trick-taking games in some respects.
Right. Yeah. No, it's, I don't know. I love the game, but I would never give this as the first one. Actually, I have another trick-taking game much higher in my top 100 that I would consider a first trick-taking game. We'll talk about that in a few weeks. But this one is great if you know trick-taking well, or if you know it a little bit, but like co-op games. Like, or if you played Hanabi and get annoyed at people cheating, this game's a lot harder to cheat on. Because you could see your own cards.
All right, well, my number 95 is and I just mentioned this previously, if it's going to be a small box game, it has to be a brilliant small box game as far as cards are concerned.
Right.
And this is No Thanks.
That is brilliant.
Exclamation point included.
Yes.
Really, all you're doing is you're taking a card and you're paying or saying no thanks and you're letting the card move along. So this reminds me of especially the original box that I own, an old school card game that our parents would play at the table. It looks kind of old school. It's got those like old school little red tokens, little plastic tokens that come into play. And basically a card comes out that's available, a particular number, right? I think it goes up to 35 from 1 to 35. You do not want points in this game at all. You don't want these cards. You want zero cards. And you want to keep as many of the red tokens as possible. That's going to score you points. The red tokens are negative. Getting close to zero or less than zero, amazing. So the cards come out. And you have, I think it's 11 little discs to start with. And you don't want to take cards. So you might say, no thanks. And you place a token on the card. Every token that's on the card brings down, you know, the point value of that particular player. So it goes around and goes around until at some point it might be worth your while to take those tokens, because as you're using those tokens to pass, you're running out of them, and then it means that you can't pass in the future. So you're going to probably at some point take a hit, take a card, hopefully get a lot of tokens. Now here's the other brilliant part of it. You can, as the game goes on, if you get other numbers in that particular sequence, so if you got a 12 and you get a 13 and you pull that into your own tableau, now you're only going to score one of those cards. And then as you go on, now you want to get 11 and 14 and 15 and 16, right? Because you're only going to score, I believe it's the top card for that. And that kind of helps you along the way. So you could get a 35. Get a lot of tokens with it, and then pull a lot of other tokens because maybe now you're getting to 34, 33, 32. I think it's the lower one. Sorry, forgive me on that. I think it's the lower one that you eventually take the point total there. It's so tense. It's a little tiny deck of cards and a bunch of chits, and it's a lot of fun. It's no thanks.
Yeah, this game is brilliant. I love this game. It's I have two copies, maybe three, floating around the house. Because I had a copy, couldn't find it, wanted a copy for my classroom, ordered another one, found the old one. And I've been hunting for, there's a German version of it, has like little stick figure art on the cards.
Oh, nice.
I've been hunting for that forever. And I saw it once at a game night. And I was like, I want that. And I've never been able to find it. So if you have it or know where to get it, let me know.
Yeah.
But yeah, the game is fantastic. Like the social dynamics of what you're doing and how you interact with each other and like forcing the bid and like, how far do I push this to make somebody take that? So I'll take it. I need the card, or I don't even need the card. I can take the card. It costs me nothing, but nobody else wants the card. Right. Like I already have a run of like 31 to 34.
Sure.
I'll take the 35. It's worth 0 points to me.
Yes.
But eventually someone's going to take the chits if you're not careful. So like it's such a good game.
I mean, the press your luck element of this is just outrageous.
Yeah.
It plays
so fast.
It does. And everyone can understand it. Like, do you want that? You don't want that. Like no. At some point. And like you said, the anxiety of, like you said, Anthony, like the 35 is out there. Nobody wants a 35. Mm-mm. But they know it doesn't cost you anything to take it. So then it's like, and you put a chit out and you put another chip out and another chip out and then another chip. And you're like, I need to pull this in because this is really good for me. And then someone else could grab it. You're just like, no.
Or it's, you do that?
Or maybe it's a middle number for you and you really want the card. How many chips do you put on it until you pull it back in? Because you know no one wants the 27, for example.
Right.
But it creates a run for you. So now instead of like having 22 to 20, you know, 35, like,
So good.
Thorsten Glimmer. Great. Amazing job. Little card game, but it packs a wallop.
Yep. All right. Next up for me at 94 is Iki. Now this is a game that originally came out back in 2015. There was a Kickstarter campaign and like in the early days of Kickstarter, where it was not highly funded. I think it was out of Japan, and I wish I had backed this because there is a scroll version.
Ooh.
That by all accounts doesn't exist. I can't find it anywhere. Not affordable. So the Kickstarter deluxe version is just absolutely beautiful. But the game itself is you are going around the market, effectively. Just this rondelle-style play. You just go around the market, the Iki market, and in Edo. And you're visiting different stalls. You're recruiting different workers. As the workers are visited, they kind of move towards retirement. And you get points from that as well. And it's just like a very simple flow to it in terms of like you're always moving forward, you're always pushing things in a certain direction, you're building up your tableau, you can see the time pass effectively as the game moves forward, which is perfectly thematic. It's amazing how it does that. The other amazing thing about the game though is just the artwork, right? It has beautiful artwork on the cards, and the original cover for this game, which I have because back in 2016 my good friend Chris lent me $55 to buy it because there was a booth selling Japanese games cash only and I had no cash. So that was amazing. So I do have this beautiful cover with like Mount Fuji in the background, kind of the ukiyo style artwork on the front. They re-released the game 2 years ago in 2022 through Sorry We're French. And it's not a bad cover. It's fine. It's just more contemporary style, right? It's just like watercolor, more fully realized modern style artwork in a regular square box. They release an expansion the next year. Expansion's good, not great. They add some more interesting ideas. But what I really love about the game is just the look and feel of it and how elegant and simple and quick it is. Like the box says 60 to 90 minutes. That is accurate. And you're making a lot of interesting decisions in those 60 to 90 minutes. It's not like, I don't know, a more recent game that tried to do this, it kind of failed at it. It was like White Castle for me. I know a lot of people love that, but it's like, it's short and it's elegant decisions. And I'm like, it feels clunky and it doesn't have a good flow to it. Iki has a beautiful flow to it. And yeah, it's highly recommended. And I was very happy when they re-released it because at least then I can recommend it to people.
Sure.
Because in the intervening 6-7 years, it was out of print.
Yes.
So check it out. It's good.
Yeah, I tried to pick this up a couple of times. I do remember the scroll version, and I'm kicking myself now for not getting that back in the day.
Oh, it's so pretty.
So it's almost, that version's almost so pretty that I can't almost imagine getting another edition. I'm just like, it's, that's the way you play it with the scroll. Like, I can't play it any other way. Like, I need, clearly this is like a time machine situation, because I don't know if I can own it otherwise.
Yeah, no, it's tough. Like, the deluxe version of the game only had 70 backers. Jeez. So, or 80, sorry, with like, there's a super deluxe. So it's just like, there aren't that many of them in the world.
No, I can't even talk about it. That's one of those things that hurts.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just the fact that the game exists at all. Like, it made like $60,000 or something, and they printed it, and they shipped it, and it's beautiful. So.
All right, well, moving from small, tiny games that I talked about as card games, stay in the tiny area. This is my favorite Oink game of all time. Like, this is my only Oink game on the list. If you don't know Oink games, they come in these really cute small boxes. That's kind of their thing. They're small, they're compact, they're innovative Japanese games. And Deep Sea Adventure was one of those games that there was just something about the aesthetic of it. It's all about being a deep sea diver going off the submarine. It has a cooperative element as far as you're all sharing the same oxygen from that sub, and you're diving deep on these little tiles. And then at some point you decide, this is the treasure I want to pick up of one of these tiles. You flip it over and then you try to take it back up to the submarine before the oxygen runs out from all the people there. And along the way, you're rolling dice. When you have treasure and you're carrying treasure now, it slows you down. So you take, a little more time to get back up. So the timing, the press your luck, the cooperative element, you're kind of pressing your luck as a group as a whole, is really interesting and dynamic. And then you do a second and a third dive. So the treasure, sometimes it doesn't make it up. You might have to drop it to try to get back up to the top or try to bring something up, kind of clumps up. So now you have an opportunity to get more treasure by not going so deep. But like, it's so competitive. And again, it's just meeples, a little ship, and a little token. And again, it's just such a wonderful little game. They have since, I think I'm not alone in this, they re-implemented it in Moon Adventure, which is the moon version of this. There's even some mini expansions and some other stuff that comes along with it if you want to pick those things up as well. But even the small box $20 game from Deep Sea Adventure from Oink Games is just fantastic.
Yeah, no, it's really good. It's honestly the one I prefer because it's portable.
Yes.
It's a little bit easier to teach. Everything's in front of people. There's no confusion. It's very straightforward.
It's an adorable little game and everyone should check it out. Because again, price especially, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. It's very cheap. Especially in modern parlance.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Number 93 for me is a game that I think was on my list once. Last time it was off my list. But I feel like I always have to have some Richard Garfield game on the list somewhere. And so this is the one that I've been playing most recently. And I really, really enjoy. I've always enjoyed this game. Bunny Kingdom. So Richard Garfield has a habit. He invented Magic the Gathering back in 93. He's rich beyond belief from that. But he keeps making games one every year or two. And, he's like, oh, here's Robo Rally. What the heck? Here's the Great Dalmudi. What the heck? King of Tokyo. I got that one in me, too. And then Bunny Kingdom kind of squeezed in there at some point. And this is an area control game in which you are drafting cards that determine where you're going to place your bunnies. Like, there's this big map with a grid. And the grid is, like, literally a grid with, like, letters and numbers. So there's, like, A7, right? And so when you draft the cards, each round, you're going to take whatever cards you get. Some of them are going to let you put bunnies on the map. Some of them are going to let you take special actions. Some are going to give you treasure. Some are scoring cards. There's a bunch of different things that come out of this deck to the point where it can be a little overwhelming the first time you play it. But ultimately, the goal is you're trying to build these different fiefdoms of bunnies throughout the map. And you're trying to get buildings out there to increase the value of those fiefdoms. And the way the values of the work is how whatever number of resources are within that fief multiplied by the number of bunnies which can be increased by the size of your towers, is how much they're worth. So the scores can get really high. Like, I've played games with people scoring in the 400s, just because, you know, they got the right multipliers and they managed to min-max out the way that they're scoring towards the end of the game. The gameplay itself, though, it's so straightforward. It's so simple. Like, the game takes less than an hour. Like, there's a lot of math in the scoring, but other than that, everything's very accessible. Weight-wise, it's very simple. I do like the expansion. I don't think it's necessary at all. It just adds a separate sideboard with more options of where to go. It's cute. You got little bunnies. It's very colorful. There's a lot of rabbit jokes and puns in the cards, which I find fun, but I'm a 40-year-old dad of two, so take that as you will. So yeah, Buddy Kingdom is fantastic. It's it cycles out every now and then. Mm-hmm. And then occasionally I'm like, I want to play an area control game. I don't like most of them. I like Buddy Kingdom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you can't remove people's stuff. Like, the thing I don't like about area control is I have this area and someone's like, cool, they're all dead now. And I'm like, cool, that was 20 minutes of time that I spent building up that force. Buddy Kingdom, once you put it on the map, it's there.
Yeah.
It's my spot. You can't have it. So it's good.
I like this game. I don't know why I don't love this game. This would certainly be a game that I would love.
Yeah, it's got all the mechanics that it's a weird thing, though. Like, it's got a lot of disparate pieces. And sure. I think for some people, they come together. And for some people, they don't.
It's very tactical. I mean, you really have to play the cards that you get with that draft.
Oh, for sure.
So it's just like, okay, I got these cards. What do I play? Like, I don't know. Go to a spot, pick a special power, get a thing. Okay, now I got more cards. All right, well, how does this work together? All right, I'm going to get a thing. And then somehow it pulls together by the end.
Yeah.
And then, like you said, the point scoring is kind of up there if you can pull something good together.
You need somebody just to be in charge of scoring. Because
it's not me, man.
Everybody wants to score their own space, and that's fine. But you need one person who's good at math to be, like, counting with them to be like, yes, that's right, or no, you did that wrong.
No, I don't need anyone. You can go ahead and do that. Because, yes, I think that's also another one of those things where it's a little cumbersome as far as counting those things up. But a very, very good game.
Yep.
All right. Well, my next game here is, and I'm surprised this wasn't on at least initially on your list, Anthony, The Duke.
Go ahead. Well,
it is for me, and this is a big thing because I grew up with chess, and then The Duke came out, and I was like, really? And I would say this is my chess replacement. You have a very small board. This is almost like such a unique little tiny game that you can play at a pub or a cafe. And it has a lot of similarities to chess. You're trying to protect your duke, and you have your knights there. And then what's so wonderful about this game, and I've yet to see it in any other game, is on these really unique, beautiful wooden pieces is the actual move that particular piece can take. And then once you take that move, you flip over the tile, and now there's a different move that piece can take, and so forth and so on. So as you move the piece, you have to think ahead as like, all right, it moves like this way now, but then it can move like this. And again, since it's on the piece, it's not cumbersome. You're never running back to the rule book. Everything is right there. Symbology is very nice and easy. And then on top of it, you don't necessarily have to always move your pieces. You can pull from your bag. You have a bag of pieces. And again, depending on the expansions that you're playing with or what you decide to put in that particular bag, you can actually pull out other special character pieces, tiles to put on the board to support your king, your duke in this case, and to take out the other characters. So there's other versions of this. This duke version is the kind of the version for me. But again, lots of really fun expansions and wonderfully beautiful pieces in a very small box, and really enjoy this. So I'm Jeremy Holcomb and Stephanie McLaughlin.
Yeah, this was, you talked about having like a 101. This is my 101. Like, I legit had a list of four games,
mm-hmm.
like off to the side on my spreadsheet of like, how do I fit these in? And it was like, well, I can't, because that's not how math works. You can't. You have 100 numbers, not 104 numbers.
Sure.
But I was like, can I swap things around? I really want this in here. And like, there was a couple that did end up making it in, and the Duke just didn't quite get there.
Gotcha.
Like, it is one of my favorite games that does this thing, like the abstract style play. So yeah, 100% agree with everything you said.
Yeah. It's, and again, I'm not a big abstract fan, as you know, and this does it for me. So this is my number 93, the Duke.
All right. 92 for me is the first of a couple Album Villard games. And this is the one that I first discovered. I didn't know who Album Villard was, and I've since gone on to like a lot of his games. But Tramways really caught my attention at first. And it almost felt like an underground find. Like, there's a guy on Board Game Geek selling a copy that was like all wrapped in plastic, and it was like a weird thing, and then you get it, and it's got like a, like this particular game specifically has like a almost a splatter feel to it, like production quality wise, like everything looks like it was printed at home. But it's a very clever take on like pick up and deliver with a deck building mechanic built in. So you have this map of the city, that the eponymous city that ends up in all of Album Villard's games, and you're building out these different types of buildings. Also appear in all of his games, you have the commercial, the residential, the leisure, and the industrial. And you're trying to put out your different tracks to move people around and score points accordingly, right? But how you do that is based on these cards that you take into your hand, which goes into a deck that you're building, which then has these other elements to it where some of those cards are good, some of them are bad. And then that leads to the auction mechanic, which is one of the more interesting auction mechanics that I've seen in a game like this, in terms of like where you're moving up this track. When it's time to do the auction, and where you ultimately get to make your decisions, it's going to determine what cards you bring in and what actions you get to take and if you get to go first or not. All that sounds more complicated than it actually is. It's relatively streamlined. It's somewhat elegant. And because of the way the game system is designed, right, with the map is just this very simple grid, but like where things are placed matters, right? Like, oh, there's mountains here. Okay, well, it costs more to build the tracks through the mountains, obviously. Or here's water. You can't go through the water unless you have a bridge. It lends itself towards all these different expansions. Like, my box is bursting with like 20, 30 different maps that he's released for this game. It plays really interestingly solo, has a really cool solo mode. But it's also just really easy to teach. What for this weight of a game, I should say. It's not easy to teach to anybody. Tramways is one of those games that sits on my shelf, and then occasionally I'm like, why am I not playing that? And then I pull it down. I'm like, this is brilliant. And no one has really done this since, like mixing like the deck building mechanic with the auction mechanic with like this map management pick up and deliver thing. It doesn't seem like it should work on paper. Like, you describe all that and someone's like, that sounds like a mess, but it's not. It's an elegant system that kind of comes together very effectively. So there's Tramways for you.
Very nice. No, it's a great game. And again, like you said, I think just because of the studio itself, it just doesn't, I don't know. Like, it just, for whatever reason, it's not marketed. It's not promoted. It's not in the mainstream enough.
Yeah. I mean, it was a very low budget type of thing.
Yeah.
And he's just kind of added stuff to it over the years. Clinic got big because he did the big Kickstarter, mm-hmm. and he got, you know, Tool. Small City, same thing. He got Quanchi Amoria. Like, I don't know if he's going to come back to Tramways. I hope so. I would definitely back like a big deluxe pretty version of this.
Yes.
But he said a few times he's done with it. So we'll see. He tends to tinker with his games forever. So we'll see.
I remember playing this. I think we played this at a convention together.
We played it at Dex. Yeah.
And I was just like, just looking at the game, I'm just like, oh no, I don't want any part of this. Like, why would you make me play this game? And it's a lot of fun.
It's very fun. Yeah. It's got that splatter look, but it plays very nicely.
It's true. All right. Number 92 here. There are many. There's almost endless numbers in this game. This is Love Letter. But I'm going to recommend, or at least put here on my number 92, the Premium Edition. Love Letter Premium Edition that came out in 2016. Love Letter, you all should hopefully know Love Letter by now. We've been talking about it for many years at this point. Again, when you're going to play a game that's a small deck of cards, and I think there are a few games that have less cards than the original Love Letter, plays great with 1 to 4 players. I'm sorry, 2 to 4 players, because again, not solo game. And on the cards itself, it has the particular rule action that that particular card can take. And basically, you are trying to protect the princess and deliver the love letter to her. And if you're able to protect the princess, or in this case, knock out the other players before they can knock you out, you're going to get a heart token. The deluxe edition has a beautiful, gorgeous box, beautiful token, beautiful sleeves. Again, the wonderful artwork, but it also can play more players. It could play up to 8 players. It has a new additional roll cards that you can add to the game that allow you to score additional points and has different activities. The original one's perfect. If you get the original one, $7 to $10 to $15, depending on what version you pick up, you're going to love it. But if you want to have the definitive edition, the best artwork, the best quality pieces and cards, and also plays up a large player count with a lot of different swap in, swap out characters, Love Letter Premium Edition. It's brilliant.
Love Letter is great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know that I ever got my hands on the premium edition, but I have like 7 copies of this floating around the house.
And it's one of those games where like there's a Batman version of Love
Letter. Yeah. I have a Jabba's Palace or something.
Yeah. I have a Munchkin version.
Yeah. It's so good. All right. My number 91, last one for this week, is Shakespeare. This came out back in 2015, and I discovered it at a local game night. Shortly after I moved to Pittsburgh, hadn't seen anything about it before that. And I was like, oh, Shakespeare. I'm an English major. I like Shakespeare. I'll play this game. And the game itself is fantastic. Like, thematically, I don't know that it's doing, I don't want to say that much. It is doing a lot of things to like show, like you're putting on a play, right? But for it to be Shakespeare, maybe not so much. The theme of the game is that you are a theater manager and you have a week to put on a play because the queen is going to come and watch. And if she likes it, she will patron your troupe. So the game takes place over 6 rounds. And in those rounds, you have to recruit crafters and actors, and you need to build sets and place costumes. And a lot of those things are somewhat abstracted. Like the set pieces, there's like a grid on your player board where you take these little squares and you place them. And they have to be symmetrical the way you place them, which is an interesting twist, but you're not actually building anything. Similarly, like the costumes are little circles that you take and you place them on the actors. Each actor has 3 spaces for these circles. And if you fill them up, then when you get to the rehearsals, they're going to score, which is what you want to have happen. Ultimately, what makes the game so interesting, though, is that at the beginning of every round, you bid for how many actions you are going to take, because if whoever bids the least gets to go first, right? And there's a limited number of cards available to pull from the tableau to recruit. You get to recruit 1 free every round. And that makes it so interesting because it's like a press your luck of like, okay, I'm not going to go first because I don't want to bid only 1 or 2. So I'm going to use all my pieces this round, whatever. Or if like, no, I need that card. I'm going to bid 2. I'm going to take 2 actions this round. I'm going to take that. I'm going to be very efficient. And so like, the economy of the game kind of shifts based on the actions people take. Like if a bunch of people take 2 or 3 actions and you've taken a lot of actions, then you know in the late game, you're like, well, I can afford to take fewer actions because I'm further ahead on all this other stuff. And then the really interesting thing is the backstage expansion gives you something to do with those worker pieces that you didn't use if you didn't bid them. So you always get to use all your pieces, which makes the game feel more complete. It's just a deck of cards. It is incredibly out of print now. Like, I picked it up at Gen Con. They just had it in the Asmodee booth, so I picked it up. So if you do find the game, try to find it with the backstage expansion, if you can. I don't know how many of those they made. But it is one of those games that I could sit down and play. It takes like 45 minutes to an hour. Very easy to teach. The artwork is very nice. You have these representations of but several different like characters from Shakespeare's plays. Like there's Iago there and Julius Caesar and all these different things that, and they're well drawn and they like really pop off of the cards. They abstract a few elements, but I really think it all comes together thematically and just mechanically. It's just such an interesting puzzle to work through. So Shakespeare.
I have not played this and I've always been upset about it.
Yeah. It's really hard to find now.
I remember looking at different stores and trying to pick this up, and because you raved about it.
Yeah.
And I was just like, yeah, no. I want to play this. I want this. And just could never get a copy of this. So, yeah, feeling bad. Just saying.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually just pulled mine out like maybe a month ago. I was like, I should play this again. And I was like, it's been a while. And I was like, oh, yeah, I love this. And I played it like 3 or 4 times. Oh,
no.
Because it's so fast, so easy to play.
Oh, that's great. All right. Well, my final game here, my number 91 is another game that I never thought I'd play. And as you'll see in my later list, small card games, not really my thing. The ones that are here, outstanding. They would not be here otherwise. Same thing with party games. Not my thing, but when they're here, they're outstanding. And one of the games way back when, Anthony and I know this, when we started Myriad Games, was a party game and also Social Deduction, which also not a fan of. But when a Social Deduction game's on my list, it's amazing. This is Shadowhunters from 2005. And the reason why I say Shadowhunters 2005 is because that's the version you want from Z-Man Games that yes. I do not own. And again, tortures me every day. I keep asking people, do you have a copy of this? Do you have a copy? Because, again, wondrous, beautiful artwork here. Just like painted, mysterious, and dark kind of characters here. And basically, there are two major factions in play. There are the Shadows and the Shadow Hunters. And some of the Shadows are from classic monster mythology, and the Shadow Hunters are trying to track them down. And also, there are civilians. These civilians are really what makes the game, for me, outstanding. These neutral players. And the Shadows want to kill the Shadow Hunters to win. The Shadow Hunters need to kill the Shadows to win. And the neutral players have all different wacky conditions. Sometimes they want other players to certainly get knocked out. Sometimes they want to get knocked out. And it really adds to the game, because otherwise it would just be like, find out which side someone is and then just end them. This one, with the unique characters, it really throws in a wrench to the whole game. Basically, those characters are given out amongst the different players. Nobody knows what character you are. And you have to figure it out by going to different locations, gaining special abilities and weapons throughout the game, and then attacking other players and seeing how they respond. And each of the characters has a different life point total. So, you know, again, sometimes you don't want to knock a character out because they could win, but sometimes they're much stronger. And then each character has a special ability that comes into play. Flip their card over, expose who they are, and then can attack other players. It just does it so well. It just does social deduction so well. It's such a beautiful version of it. Some of this is you can be seen in like Battlestar Galactica that we talked about, one of our games that, you know, rose up to our Hall of Fame. This does it so very well. Shadowhunters, my number 91. And also, just a warning, it's been re-implemented in what Cosmo Games calls Fangs. Don't pick up that version. Unless you're desperate, like me, and I picked it up, and I'm not happy. But yeah, Shadowhunters. Find the Shadowhunters version. Or
it's
the Japanese version, which is Shadow Raiders, which is not in print anywhere here. So yeah.
Yeah, neither is Shadowhunters.
No, it's not, yeah.
Yeah, I was just looking at on Board Game Geek. It's like $200. Oh, okay, never mind.
No, yeah, No. Don't do that. Don't do that to yourself. Shadow Raiders is a little more recent. It came out in 2018. It looks like a really cool light version of it, and I would pick that one up too. But it's also Japanese, and there's no English version.
Ah, that's tough. Yeah, this game is fantastic. I love it. I have a memory of playing it on my back porch in Staten Island on like 4th of July after a barbecue.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I don't like social deduction at all. Like, I run away when I see these games come out. But Shadowhunters didn't feel like social deduction, even though obviously that's what it is. Because it had the board game elements to it.
Yes.
So good.
All right. Well, there you go, everybody. There is the beginning. Our number 100 to number 91 of our top 100 games of all time. Each week until we reach our episode 500, we'll be taking a look at each of our top 10s of that particular week. Again, thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for sharing all the episodes and supporting. Until next time, this is Chris.
And this is Anthony.
And we'll save you all. I'll see you at the table. Take care, everyone.
This podcast is brought to you by the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection Arcade Classics. 7 legendary titles, including X-Men vs. Street Fighter and Marvel vs. Capcom 2. Enjoy new features like online multiplayer, training, and gallery modes. Plus, join in on the action with one-button specials, where players of all skill levels can unleash those epic moves with ease. Relive the classic arcade battles. Get your hands on the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection today. Available now on PlayStation 4, PC, and Nintendo Switch.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.